Some of the most instructive biographies are the ones that tell us about a person we may not have heard of, but whose life story gives us a chance to better understand certain times and trends. So it is with the life of Edward Proctor Hunt, who was born Daybreak into a tribe in New Mexico around the start of the Civil War. He and his time are profiled in the book How the World Moves, The Odyssey of an American Indian Family by Peter Nabokov. Hunt managed to straddle Native and white cultures at a time when Native culture was obviously in sharp decline. We learn a lot about our country and our ancestors through the story of his life. Peter Nabokov is professor of American Indian Studies and World Arts and Cultures at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles. He has written several other books and was the editor of Native American Testimony. Peter, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you so much.
A very big and comprehensive book about a person not terribly well known, I would venture to say. What makes him such a pivotal figure?
He is one of those folks, as you very nicely described, who did indeed straddle or navigate between cultures. And that initial exposure to the outside world took place when he was quite young. And of course, there were emissaries coming to western New Mexico from the Protestant faith, trying to pull away youngsters to the new boarding schools. And the newest boarding school was one that was about to start in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And so after having undergone a number of initiations in his own tribe, the Acoma Pueblo people of western New Mexico, an unusual number of initiations due to unusual circumstances, getting kicked in the head by a horse and being prepared for death, which sort of set him up to become a medicine man or a healer, initiations into the Kachina Society, and later on, initiation into the Sacred Clown Society. So he had this immersion on the one hand into the depths and esoteric depths of his own people, and then he was plucked with a number of other, about 30 other kids, to go to Albuquerque and to start and actually build the first boarding school there. And that required, as it did with so many youngsters across the United States, so many Indian youngsters, a complete cultural transformation. Their hair was cut. They were put in their uniforms. The boys were separated from the girls. They were not supposed to communicate with their family. He didn't for 3 years. And this transformation was a traumatic experience. And many kids came back to the reservations, sort of caught between worlds. Mr. Hunt, on the other hand, for some reason, Protestantism on the one hand, and the ethics of an entrepreneur, a budding entrepreneur, they took hold in his psyche and his personality. So when he returned to the Pueblo, he was a Christian in his heart, and he kept that identity to himself. And all of that blossomed when he fell in love, married a woman who herself from the Pueblo, who herself was the sister-in-law of all things, a Jewish trader who became the governor of Acoma Pueblo. So suddenly our man, Mr. Daybreak, who has been given a name, Edward Hunt, in school, as oftentimes happened, kids were renamed with white names, suddenly has a Jewish trader, entrepreneur, runs a trading post, brother-in-law, who trains him in running a shop and becoming a storekeeper. And he's kind of, his fortunes are suddenly rise because when his brother-in-law leaves for San Francisco with his Indian wife, our man, Mr. Hunt, is sort of fills the economic vacuum in that part of western New Mexico. And already, as you can tell from what I just said, there are so many contradictory value structures that underlie this transformation, and he's embodying all of them. So here we have an ordinary man, in terms of your question, an ordinary man who is carrying a extraordinary burden of bicultural identity.
I understand the work on this began in earnest with something called Bulletin Number 135. What was that?
I was in Washington, D.C. in 1993, and I asked about Bulletin 135, which was the origin myth of Occam of Pueblo, and it was told at the Smithsonian Institution in 1928 by an anonymous person. And I asked folks at the Smithsonian when I was working on another project on American Indians in Yellowstone Park if they had any idea of the identity of this person, and they rustled around. And they were able to find the identity, and they were also able to find a phone number for me of the last of Mr. Hunt's 12 children, the last surviving of his 12 children. And I called that number in July of 1993 upon my return from Washington, and a gentleman answered the phone, an old man, and he allowed that he was indeed the last surviving son, that he had been in Washington when his father had narrated the myth, that he himself had helped to translate the song, the lyrics to the songs that were part of the story. And that sort of clued me in. I flew out to Albuquerque and talked with him, and he told me the outlines, of which I only just sketched the beginnings for you, of this man's just unusual history. And
Pick it up on the other side of a break. More about Edward Proctor Hunt, also known as Daybreak, with Peter Nabokov. Back on The Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is UCLA Professor of American Indian Studies and World Arts and Cultures, Peter Nabokov. He's the author of a big new book called How the World Moves, The Odyssey of an American Indian Family. It is focused on a man who came to be known as Edward Proctor Hunt. He was born into the Occam of Pueblo in 1861, so obviously born into a native culture at a time when native cultures were in sharp decline and continued to do so throughout his lifetime. Edward Proctor Hunt was what he went by later in life, and his journey straddling both cultures is an amazing testament to our fascination and our extermination of American Indians at the same time. You can join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So the origin story that you found in the Smithsonian led you to Wilbert, the last, as you pointed out, of Edward Proctor Hunt's children, and you went to meet him.
Yes, I did go to meet him in Albuquerque, and that started a series of interviews with Wilbert and extended family members that lasted until Wilbert Hunt's death in 2007. What I didn't expect was that this foray into the life of an extraordinary person, but not somebody who became famous as a political figure or notable, nobody would know his name really, was that it would lead me into writing a 150-year history of the West and Western New Mexico as seen through the eyes of this multi-generational family. And that it took so long because there were so many chapters and context that I had to build into it, which involved, as you mentioned, the post-Civil War period, involved the turn of the century when populations were declining, involved World War I, the Depression, World War II. Wilbert Hunt served 4 years in Europe during World War II. He was General Patton's barber. It involved the family becoming part of a Wild West show and traveling throughout Europe for 2 years. In 1927 and 28, and them learning the trade of being show Indians and finding that when they returned to the States after that European sojourn and after telling the myth, that they actually had a livelihood. And that livelihood, thanks to the Boy Scouts of America, was Indian lore. So they began to create their own career after a certain series of estrangements from their original Pueblo, living in America as a floating family of dancers, of curio shop operators, of painters, and they got involved in Indian circles in Tulsa, Oklahoma, as well as in Santa Fe and Albuquerque. They sort of became your stock and trade Indian, available for any Thanksgiving pageant, Song of Hiawatha, theater piece. And it was that unusual career that sort of compelled me, because they were not alone in being Indians estranged from their roots who had to create a livelihood at a time when the options open for Indian employment were not great. There were no Indian policemen or Indian firemen or even Indian sales clerks in Albuquerque at that time, and they had to create their own livelihood. And I found this a uniquely American story in their entrepreneurial spirit. Here we have American Indians as entrepreneurs. So I just couldn't let it go and had to explore every nook and cranny, and that's why it took so long.
Ended up with a big book with lots of pictures, but a story well told. Let's talk about from the beginning of Edward Proctor Hunt's life, or Daybreak as he was known, upon his birth in 1861. His people, the Acoma people, and I should point out to listeners, it's spelled A-C-O-M-A, so it looks like Acoma, pronounced Acoma. How I mean, they had been exposed to European culture for centuries by the time he was born, hadn't they?
They had. In 1540, the Spanish arrived. Coronado arrives. The Spanish imposition on Pueblo life is light at first, but intensifies. And finally, into the early 17th century, it begins to impose itself on Pueblo Indian religion. The Franciscans attempt to suppress American Indian, outlaw American Indian religion, and punish any people that are adherents to it, particularly the medicine men, the shamans, and the Indian priests. And finally, this causes the uprising of 1680. All the Pueblos unanimously and simultaneously, remarkably, over 400 miles, rise up on August 10th, 1680, and drive the Spanish out of the Southwest. It's a remarkable story. It's a fight for freedom, the like of which no other American Indian group can lay claim to. They actually had a successful uprising. And when I say successful, even though the Spanish reconquered the area in 1692, 12 years later, their power was never the same again. Their power was crippled, and they allowed the Indians to pursue their own religious traditions. And they kind of stood back when dances would take over the plaza or other rituals would take place in the sacred kivas where the medicine men met.
So we're talking 180 years before the birth of Daybreak, and yet it sounds like he did not encounter his first white people until he was several years along in life.
He did not. He did not. There's a moving little, you know, I based this entire book on 18 typed pages from his own mouth. That's all I had.
Uh-huh.
The rest of the material came from his son and were memories and stories that had been, like all of us with our families, we tell particular narratives that describe the character or personality of a given family member, a grandparent or whatever, and they become well-oiled over time. And so I had a lot of those. But from the man's own mouth, from Edward Hunt's own mouth, I only had 18 pages. But one of the memories that is in those 18 pages is remembering seeing a covered wagon. And he was told it was Texans, and they were heading toward the setting sun. And I found that a sort of symbolic, you know, the West is still to be explored when he's a kid in the late 1860s. And he saw that from this relatively removed and isolated world of Acoma Pueblo. I mean, after all, the community sits on top of a 375-foot-high sandstone mesa and has kind of utilized that perch to observe the world around it and to try to stay, to some degree, removed from the world around it.
But there were white people who came to research their beliefs, for example, and I wonder how welcoming the Acoma were to people in that position.
Well, it's a good question, and they were unwelcome. And one of the things about Edward Hunt early on, it's particularly as soon as he got his store, that worried his neighbors was how his open door to people like Elsie Clouse Parsons and Franz Boas and Leslie White and the great photographer, actually from here in Seattle, Edward Curtis. Edward Curtis, in his book in his 20 volumes, describes Edward Hunt by name as being the one person among the Pueblos, the Western Pueblos, who helped him out, helped him find locations for photography and got information for him about Acoma Pueblo. So the other people at the community frowned on this kind of disclosure, to be sure. And that helped to create animosity and a distance. And finally, Edward, due to the fact that he had he'd become wealthy as a storekeeper, he'd done well for himself. After beginning a life in relative poverty, he ended up with a relatively rich person. That did not abide in an egalitarian community like Acoma. And so ultimately there was a break and he had to move.
Edward Proctor Hunt is the person we're talking about here with Peter Nabokov, who's a professor of American Indian Studies at UCLA. He's the author of How the World Moves, The Odyssey of an American Indian Family, tracing the life of Edward Proctor Hunt and his descendants. Edward Proctor Hunt himself born in 1861, so very much at a time when there was great pressure on Native Americans across the country. You can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. It sounds like it didn't take very long for the man who became Edward Proctor Hunt to get to a position where he wasn't entirely welcome among the people of his birth, and because of the fact that he was a Native American, not entirely welcome among people in the white world, unless he represented as a representative of Native America.
That's the irony. And the irony is compounded by the fact that the kind of Indians that people wanted to see chasing stagecoaches in Wild West show arenas, both at home and abroad, were not Pueblo Indians. They were Plains Indians, and preferably Sioux Indians, members of the Sioux tribe from South Dakota, the various Sioux tribes from South Dakota. So Edward had to learn, and his boys, and his wife to some extent, they had to learn how to become stage Indians, which meant the public idea of Plains Indians. And they took on that as a sort of challenge to, on the one hand, do what they were told, which was to chase stagecoaches and to walk around in war bonnets that were not usual in their home community. But they took it as an opportunity also to answer questions and to talk about Acoma. So they were sort of carrying two Indian traditions. One was the stage Indian tradition that was created by popular culture. Early on, it was dime novels and the rest. Later, it would become grade B cowboy and Indian films, as well as when it came time for one-on-one chats to talk about their home Pueblo. He talked about the antelope hunts that he had participated in. He talked about living on the mesa and what it was like to interact with Navajos, for example, who in the early years of his life were still pillaging the Pueblo people. So he, the burden of the family, I mean, they took on the role of being your popular intermediaries from the Indian world to popular audiences. At the same time that Mr. Hunt was also communicating to scholars the more authentic, the more detailed accounts of Pueblo Indian life. It was a complicated operation.
It sounds like, from the way you describe him in the book, though, that he was a bit of a sponge for culture at both ends. I mean, both at the Acoma Pueblo and then also when he was sent away to boarding school. It seemed like he just picked up every little bit of culture he could get.
That's a good observation, and I think that tendency, which I think was innate. I actually think it was innate. I mean, he was not a particularly publicly introspective person, so some of this I have to read into it the way you just were reading into it. Mm-hmm. But I get the sense that Solomon Bibo, who is the Jewish brother-in-law that I alluded to earlier, was also a person. You see, a storekeeper has to do that. A successful storekeeper is somebody who is susceptible to and interested in the cultures of his or her clients, mostly his clients. And in the case of Solomon Bibo, he ended up speaking five languages, most of them American Indian languages. I mean, there was his native German, there was Yiddish, there was English, there was Hispanic, there was Carizan, the language of the Acoma people. There was Navajo to some extent because he traded with Navajos in the currency of sheep. So there is this openness, and I think Edward Hunt always displayed an interest in the outside world. When his boy was in World War II, he pinned a map of the world in the kitchen and would use stick pins to follow Wilbert's progress from D-Day on up to Paris. When they went to Dresden, Germany in 1927 to affiliate with an Italian circus that was based there, they loved to walk around and see the cathedrals and enjoy the Baroque architecture of Dresden, which at that time was one of the jewels of Europe before the bombing in 1945 that obliterated the city. And so there was this openness. There had been the openness to the German Jews. There had been the openness to the Hispanic culture. You have to know about these cultures if you're going to have goods on your shelves to sell to them at particular times of their year. And, of course, the Hispanic cultures are following an intense Catholicism there in New Mexico, and they would need goods at a particular time. So there was this sponge-like, as you refer to it, receptivity to the outside world, for sure.
Peter Nabokov, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book about Edward Proctor Hunt and his family is called How the World Moves. I'm struck, you were just talking about the fact that they were on tour in Europe as a family. This is when Edward Proctor Hunt was going by the name Big Snake. Was that his stage name?
Yeah, he got that stage name in northern Oklahoma. The whole business of becoming show Indians, as we call them, stage show Indians, West Wild West show Indians, began at a very unique establishment in northern Oklahoma called the Miller Brothers 101 Ranch Circus. And the family met there. Actually, Wilbert ran away from boarding school one night in order to join his parents and his brother there. In northern Oklahoma, and this was the last of the great Wild West shows that began in the 1880s with Buffalo Bill Cody and his Wild West show that also traveled to Europe. And the last of the big ones was the Miller Brothers, and that was going until the end of the 1920s, and they ended up there, and that's where they learned how to become stage Indians, you know, with all the usual postures, looking into the distance as the Indian scout, holding their hands up to the rising sun in supplication as spiritual Indians. So that's where they learned to act as spiritual Indians and to act as savage Indians according to their audience's desires.
Which still strikes us hard, I think, when we think about the fascination Europe, you mentioned, was part of it. But in America, too, and there's a picture in the book of something I've come to know as a railroad buff over the years, the people meeting trains in New Mexico on the Atchison,
right,
Topeka, and Santa Fe,
right,
selling Indian curios and things like that. So there's this great fascination with the culture that at the same time there's this effort of extermination.
It is a contradiction, and the contradiction reaches a peak in the 1920s when we really fail to appreciate the degree to which the passion for Indian lore gripped the country. And the ethnographic reports produced by the Smithsonian especially, and other institutions, but primarily the Smithsonian's, were re-excavated for popular consumption. And books, popular books, were written about Indian poetry and Indian song, and this was the time when the Boy Scouts were created. And then the offshoots of the Boy Scouts, the Order of the Arrow, would come later, and the Koshari Indian Boy Scout troop from Colorado that toured the country. So that passion developed strongly, and that passion was very much a product of the Southwest because of the fights that the Pueblo Indian people were having at the time, and their supporters were artists and intellectuals from the East Coast who had migrated to Santa Fe and Taos, New Mexico. And it probably was the most unified lobbying effort in the history of the American left, oddly enough, to support Pueblo Indian land rights and Pueblo Indian religious rights. And the Hunt family was caught up in the middle of all of that and benefiting from it because this produced the audience that they would then satisfy in their trips around the United States.
So their effort to make a living really depended a bit on this tension, or at least this interest in Native culture.
Absolutely. And it was a reversal. I mean, 50 years before, Indians were savages. 50 years before, Indians were to be obliterated. 50 years before, Indians were to be assimilated into white culture. And suddenly you have this about-face. Vine Deloria, the great American Indian philosopher and writer and polemicist, said that this, you have this reverse. By the 1960s, you were having this reversal every 25 years, you know, and we can see this happening in government policy. In the 1930s, suddenly we have a commissioner of Indian Affairs who actually led the fight on behalf of the Pueblos to retain their land rights, and he becomes commissioner of Indian Affairs under Roosevelt. His name is John Collier, and we have a revolution in Indian Affairs. In the 1950s, that gets reversed, and suddenly the idea is government must get out of the Indian business. Indians should relocate to the cities. Reservations should be terminated. And then, come the 1960s and 70s, you have suddenly the passion for Indians develops once again. And you have Edward Curtis photographs on the walls of college students everywhere. So it's Indians are subject to these oscillating passions of the dominant culture.
And some of those we know well in our own region because we've had tribes like the Klamath decertified in the late 50s and then recertified in the mid-80s. We'll get back into the discussion of Edward Proctor Hunt and his family and their lives. In the book, How the World Moves, The Odyssey of an American Indian Family, Peter Nabokov, its author, our guest. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange with Peter Nabokov and you in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Peter Nabokov. He's a professor of American Indian Studies and World Arts and Cultures at UCLA, the University of California, Los Angeles. Written a bunch of books. His most recent one is called How the World Moves, The Odyssey of an American Indian Family, and it is told through the story of Edward Proctor Hunt, who was born at the Acoma Indian Pueblo as daybreak in 1861, so his life really spans the period where the greatest pressure to either move or exterminate or assimilate Americans, Native Americans, existed. And you can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Anne in Eugene, thanks for holding. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Peter Nabokov.
Thank you. Well, as awful as the experience was for the African slaves, they were regarded as valuable livestock, whereas the indigenous peoples of North and South America were simply regarded as an impediment to be eliminated. And how any of them managed to survive the horrible diseases that they weren't genetically able to fight off, the wars, just the destruction of their culture is quite amazing. And thank you for writing this book.
All right. Thanks. Thanks for the comments, Anne. Appreciate that. Peter, thoughts?
Well, actually, I would like to just adjust the statement a little bit because a lot of American Indians were slaves. A lot of American Indians were transferred as indentured servants to Mexico. A lot of Indians in the Southwest were virtual slaves. And you have the pattern of slavery among American Indians. And by the way, American Indians also some tribes taking slaves from other tribes. So it's a very, there's a wonderful book called Captives and Cousins, which is about this in the Southwest, about the slavery and indentured servitude in the Southwest. It's a little more complicated than that. I understand the comparison that the caller is drawing, but the actual story is much more complex and highly localized, very, very different from region to region.
And there's a lot in your own book about intermixing, intermarriage. And in fact, Edward, his father came from outside the tribe. Is that true?
It's believed. You know, it's one of those, again, you're writing about a family and families keep their own secrets. And I was always hesitant about pushing too strongly on the actual identity of Edward Hunt's father. And in point of fact, in Indian cultures, the genetic father usually is not as important as the father or the male figure that raises the kid, and quite often that's mother's brother rather than the genetic father. But be that as it may, and it's sort of the Puritan or Protestant fixation on racial purity that is also embedded in our federal system of identification of who's an Indian and who's not, that misreads how Indians describe identity and who belongs to whom and the importance of adoption, for example. But it is a fact that probably Mr. Hunt's father was not an Acoma Indian, that perhaps he was Hispanic, and even Wilbert, his son, allowed as to how that was probably the case.
What were you able to determine? And you mentioned earlier that you had about 18 pages of stuff that Edward Proctor Hunt himself had written that helped
right.
you, and everything else had to be divined through other sources.
Right.
What were you able to determine, though, about Edward's intentions? I mean, did he plan out his life and, you know, say, this is what I'm going to do with myself and make some clear choices? Or was it just a case of he took the opportunities presented to him?
I think they were the opportunities presented to him, and those opportunities were quite unusual. And he retained things from each of the experiences and added them up to create a new kind of multi-purpose identity as an Indian. And I think that had I the opportunity to talk to him before he passed away in 1948, this is precisely what I would have wanted to know. And I don't think it would have been easy to get a clear answer, because I think one would have been excavating various levels in his consciousness and various kinds of identity that he felt he possessed. I don't think it was a solid single thing.
Well, so the question that really runs through the book is one of cultural identity and whether it's a fixed constant or something more fluid.
Right. Well, anthropologists, we're trained to talking about primordial identity and constructivist identity. Primordial identity, that which one does get through one's birth and one's home culture, and then constructivist identity, which, as you suggested in other terms, is an identity that is created by circumstance over time. And I think for Mr. Hunt, it was a bit of both. I mean, while he never participated in the medicine men's training, he never activated his training as a medicine man that he had learned, and while he retained his Christian identity and kept his Bible to his side for the rest of his entire life, the Bible that he'd received as a donation in boarding school, he also continued to practice certain, what will you call them, rituals. For there's a naming ceremony in which a person gets a name. He got his at the age of 4. He did that for his grandchildren, and there's a photograph in the book of Edward and his wife Marie in Plains Indian dress in the backyard in Albuquerque, giving a name to their granddaughter in traditional Ockhama style. And that suggests to you how he cobbled together traditions, but I think retained a deep affection for the Indian tradition that raised him. And when his boy was going to World War II and was about to leave, he gave him a pouch with a arrowhead, a chipped rock, a stone arrowhead inside it that would protect him as a warrior in the way that Ockhama warriors used to be protected when they would go after Navajos.
I want to ask about rejection and whether any of that existed. I mean, whether because of him going further into the white world as Edward Proctor Hunt, if he was no longer welcome among the Ockhama people, and then on the other hand, if there were times when he had got fed up with white culture and what it did to Native Americans.
The second question is a great question, and I wish I knew. I just don't know. I don't know. I do know that there were a couple times where somebody was insulting to him. One time it was a Catholic priest, and he ordered the man out of his house because the Catholic priest said he should never be reading the Bible independently. A priest was supposed to intercede and intermediate with the Bible for parishioners, and he ordered that man out of his house. He got irritated. Other than that, he seems to have been quite mild-mannered. But he definitely was ostracized. He definitely was hurt by the fact that Ockhama people rejected his progressive attitudes, his friendship with the Indian agent, his openness to the outside culture. There was he winced. You get a sense that he winced at the fact that people would walk stony faced past his trading post and not enter it after a while. But this was a strong personality, is my impression, a very strong personality. And after all that he suffered, much of which I have not gone into in our interview, being ostracized from the tribe with his young wife when she was pregnant for the first 3 years of their marriage, and other indignities, after that, I don't think he was going to let anything hurt him from the outside anymore.
How did he meet his wife?
She was from a well-born family up on the Mesa, And everybody knew everybody. This is what we call in anthropology a face-to-face society. So if you have 600-700 people up on top of the mesa, everybody's going to know everybody. And his mother, because she was the wife of a medicine man, and medicine men are all usually poor because they're spending all their time healing or creating ceremonies of one sort or another and kind of dependent on the charity of others to help them out because of the service that they provide. His mother was grinding corn for the well-to-do mother of his wife-to-be, and that girl remembered this poor boy sitting beside his mother and scrounging at the crumbs of corn that spilled off her matate, her grinding stone, and it took pity on him. And I think that that relationship blossomed from childhood, and they knew each other, and love flowered.
12 children, you say, altogether?
I beg your pardon?
With 12 children, you said they had?
12 children altogether, exactly. One of them died at childbirth. Two of them died from tuberculosis that was contracted at school, at boarding school. They went to boarding school and had to be sent home and passed away. And the rest lived on. The boys had different careers. The one that I profile besides Wilbert was named Henry Wayne Wolfrobe Hunt, and his career was of special interest to me because he moved to Oklahoma, which gave me the opportunity, in talking about 150 years of Indian-white relations in the West, to talk about the uniqueness of Oklahoma as a sort of gigantic refugee camp for Indians from all over the country, including the Hunt family, who established a trading post there in Catoosa, Oklahoma, on Route 66.
I still remember looking at older maps of the United States and seeing what is now Oklahoma referred to as Indian territory.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Oklahoma itself is a Choctaw word for red man.
So in addition to putting out this large book about the Edward Proctor Hunt family, How the World Moves, you also have published simultaneously from Viking Press The Origin Myth of Acoma Pueblo, which was Edward Proctor Hunt's own writing, edited by you. Tell us a bit about that project.
Well, he told that story at the Smithsonian in 1928, and it was edited by a number of people until it was finally published in 1942. It kind of was coming out during World War II. It didn't get much notice, but shortly thereafter, the accessibility of the myth began to catch the attention of anthologizers. So a lot of anthologizers used it in their books as an example of a Pueblo origin story that was lucid and could be appreciated by anybody. And then ultimately, it found its way on the web, and I thought that it deserved a republication. I thought that, however, that the photographs and the pictures that were accompanying it would prove dismaying, or that the Pueblos would not care to see that blatantly presented. So the version that I edited for for Penguin Classics does not have any of those pictures. And I also felt that it deserved an introduction. So often, American Indians that joined with scholars to prepare materials on their tribes went unacknowledged, and their contributions, their collaborations, were never honored. And I felt that this work deserved an explanation, a brief explanation of Mr. Hunt's life and the editing work that went into it.
Did Edward Proctor Hunt get any static from Acoma Pueblo about publishing The Origin Myth or telling it to the Smithsonian?
I don't think they knew about it. I don't think they knew about it. It was the subject of a 400-page book published in France and never translated into English because, as I said, scholars everywhere have used it and drawn material from it. But I think that it was more the general fact of Edward's openness to any scholars who came through, and those would include three of the editors who worked on the myth, Franz Boas, Elsie Clues Parsons, and Leslie White.
Any blowback for you delving as deeply as you do into Native American?
Yeah, there has been. Mm-hmm. There has been. There has been. And I've appeared most recently before the Acoma Tribal Council to hear their concerns and objections, and now we're in conversations about how to resolve it.
Really? And what might be some of the steps that have been discussed?
Well, I can't really talk about it because we're in conversations and it's a delicate issue.
Uh-huh. What's been the general response? It's been about a month now since How the World Moves came out. What kind of responses are you getting to that?
You know, as I said at the outset, it's a difficult book because it's 150 years of Indian-white relations, and I kept fighting and writing it. I mean, it's taken me over 20 years to finish this major book, and it's been very difficult to organize, and I've tried to keep in touch with the readers. Impatient system, and yet I'm afraid that some people have felt that the organization has too many sidebars, has too many side stories. But whether it's Indians in Oklahoma or whether it's Indians after the Civil War, I saw here the opportunity to have a spinal cord, to have a through line of a person's life who is fairly unknown, but who touched so many elements of Indian-white relations from the end of the Civil War virtually to the present day, and I couldn't not include them, even though I worked so hard to streamline them as best I could. So
definitely,
some people have said that it's too many sidebars. Some people have said they just love the sidebars. So that's about it. I think people are enjoying it.
Definitely a fascinating story. How the World Moved: The Odyssey of an American Indian Family. Peter Nabokov, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for your good questions.